أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا، أبي القاسم محمد. وعلى أهل البيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين، ولعن الله أعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. والذين جاهدوا فينا لنهدينهم سبلنا وإن الله لمع المحسنين. صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد. The internal battle of Islam has been the topic given to these lectures. Tonight is lecture number 3. Our topic 2 nights ago, as a quick recap like we do every night, we started off by talking about this very famous debate about Islam versus modernism. Is Islam modern? Does Islam need to be modern? This idea that Islam needs to fit in today's society. In fact, does Islam indeed fit in today's society? And the challenges that come about on the table, those who are the modernist, quote unquote, are those individuals who bring to the table the debate that Islam's many laws and regulations are those laws and regulations that were applicable in the time of the Holy Prophet. And they have since been outdated, and they have since been labeled as prehistoric, and they need to be modified and reformed to fit today's society. And yesterday we talked a little bit about this idea that Islam is a religion based on nature, on the intrinsic nature of man. And as we know, the intrinsic nature of man, known as a fitrat, does not change. And thus this discussion on whether or not Islam is modern or not is really an absurd discussion. But one that seems to be gaining some steam, unfortunately, especially in the West. And so it needs to be discussed, and we need to make sure that our youth out there are not confused. We talked about issues of conviction and insight yesterday to be two of the main ingredients to battle these kinds of thoughts, to make sure that this type of ideology doesn't infiltrate inside of your system. And we want to make sure, the reason why we call it the internal battle of Islam is simply because those individuals that battle Islam or that challenge Islam are the Muslims, unfortunately. The reformists, as they're known. People who, like I said, believe Islam needs to be a little bit different in today's day and age. And their biggest battle and their biggest discussion and problem with Islam is Islam's source of freedom. And Islam's definition of freedom. And it seems that in the past 4 or 5 years at least, freedom has been one of those discussions that doesn't seem to want to go away. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
I've been here long enough at Sabah for all of you to know my intentions and know who I am and how I am. And so you know that whatever I say to all of you as my youth, I say it as an older brother and as somebody who has immense love and affection for all of you. I feel a need right now to pause my speech and then let you know something, and then we'll, you know, press play again on the speech. These gatherings that we have where Imam Hussein is remembered, and this goes to my parents in the audience and to my youth as well, these are not ordinary gatherings. We have a hadith by our 8th Imam, Imam Radha alayhi salatu wa salam.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
He says, "Man jalasa majlasan yuhya fihi amruna lam yamut qalbu." The one who sits in a gathering where our affairs are mentioned, the Ahlul Bayt's affairs are mentioned, where we're discussed, his heart never dies. يَوْمَ تَمُوتُ الْقُلُوبُ. On the day where the hearts will die of fear, this brother, this sister who sits in these gatherings, his heart, her heart will never die. So these gatherings are no ordinary gatherings and cannot be treated as ordinary gatherings. Thus we have in our books an entire respect given to the way that we are to enter these gatherings, even sit in these gatherings. And I want our parents to preach this to their kids. Teach your children how to sit in these gatherings, the clothes to wear when they enter these types of gatherings, the respect, the adab, as they say in Urdu, to be given to these types of gatherings. Now yesterday, I had to pause my speech to ask my youth to come and sit properly off the walls, and today, like fearless individuals, they go right back on that same wall again. And they expect me to forget about yesterday. So again, I'll ask and I'll pause my speech again and I'll ask my young brothers to come in the front here, have a seat. Let's enjoy this discussion, inshallah. Let's learn something, inshallah. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. I know some of you have been dragged here kicking and screaming, but inshallah, we'll do our best to keep it as lively as possible. But I ask the parents, please, if you can, you know, when you teach them everything else, make it a point to also teach them that these gatherings require you to be a little bit more respectful than we're seeing, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now let's press play on our discussion and let's move on. So the number one problem that individuals who are known as Islamic reformists in today's day and age, they have several issues with Islam. And I'm sure all of you have read these issues. The main ones revolve around freedom. Islam has one version of freedom, and the West and this society has one version of freedom. And I want our youth to understand this idea, because they will present to you an Islam that holds its followers as captives and prisoners, and will say that your freedom is a little bit too free for us. And so there seems to be a little bit of a battle here. So let's discuss this, let's explore it. And again, the purpose is, and this topic was chosen very carefully, because right now we believe, and when I say we, I think some of the ulama and those who are students of the Hawza believe that Islam is very gharib, as they say in Urdu. Islam has been oppressed time and time again. Islam continues to be oppressed. This religion that came about to bring about peace amongst humanity, this religion that is a solution of all of mankind, has now been labeled as a bloodthirsty religion, has now been labeled as a terrorist religion, has now been labeled as a religion that breeds individuals who are war hungry and bloodthirsty. And as famously as we hear, it's so cliche, it's been hijacked by the wrong people. In our religion, mind you. I'm talking about Muslims themselves who have hijacked this religion of ours. That's a religion of peace, really. And we, as defenders of that religion, have to do just that. We have to defend the religion now. Right? It's a very lonely religion. It's become completely isolated. It's been completely left alone by the Muslims. Completely left alone, the religion. To fend for itself, and right now it's getting battered and bruised across the world in the media. And we as Muslims have a responsibility towards our own deen to stand up and defend it. And so what we're trying to do in these next now two nights after this is simply give the tools possible to defend the system here in the West. All of you are on the front lines in terms of the defense system of Islam. The battle in the East is one, the battle in the West is another. And sometimes the battle here at home is much more tougher. It's an intellectual battle, whereas over there it's a physical battle. So we need to kind of step up, boys. Grab it by the horns and take it to prosperity. And that's not happening. And thus these individuals come and they rant, they rave, they talk their garbage and they get away with it. And so we're simply trying to kind of address these issues. First of all, it's important for us to understand that in the name of freedom in this part of the world, a lot has been done. they'll publish disgusting magazines and they'll limit the, you know, the freedom of press, for example. They'll worship Satan and they'll say freedom to worship. You know, they will insult our prophet. They'll say things about our leaders and they'll say it's a freedom of speech. And so they take this concept of freedom, which really is a blessing of God, and they have really itched it towards this idea of a license to do whatever they want to do in the name of freedom. And they call that freedom. So what they've done is they've taken this idea of freedom, you know, even in their anthem, you guys have the land of the free and the home of the brave, right? This is the land of the free right now. And that freedom has been completely and absolutely taken apart to simply be a license to do whatever you want, call it freedom, and nobody touches you. So their version of freedom is what? To open the cage of the bird, let the bird out, and the bird can go from nest to branch, and you can't say a thing about it. And they present that as freedom. Islam takes that freedom and calls it chaos. Doesn't call it freedom. Because simply allowing us to do whatever we want to do is not freedom. In some areas, that's injustice towards the human race. So now what happens is that the reality is that we're not free individuals in this country. We're not. We are asked to go a certain speed on the highway. We are asked to not commit certain crimes, we can't wear certain t-shirts, we can't wave certain flags downtown, we can't use certain words in our speeches, we can't wear an anti-president t-shirt. You might get kicked out of school, I've heard about that happening in the US. All these things that they believe is a free country, it really isn't a free country. Because we are, as human beings, now humanity, we are created to run off of laws and regulations. We demand discipline. We're programmed to work off of discipline. If you left us to do whatever you want to do, go as fast as you want, commit as many crimes, it's a free-for-all, this would be a society of chaos. And none of you guys, none of us would want to live in a society. So the reality is that there is some enslavement in this society as well. They pick and choose what you need to be enslaved about. Islam says there's no doubt, there's enslavement as well. You're not completely free as well. The source of the enslavement is different. The source of the enslavement in this society is different. This society will tell us, especially our youth, that your nafs is your God. If your nafs desires something, go out and get it. You want to buy something, you already have 10 of those things, go and buy it. 14 pairs of shoes, mashallah. You want to buy the 50th pair? Go buy it. You have the money, you worked hard, go. You want to love somebody? Go love them. Doesn't matter if same gender, doesn't matter. Love them. It's your heart. Who are they to tell you who to love? Go crazy. And fight them, then fight for the rights to get, you know, marriage and etc. How long is that going to last? Because the reality is that right now in this day and age, and a lot of you will attest to this, this idea of trying to control society has now begun to creep in. They're telling you now to control the intake of food. You guys have a problem with obesity in this country. Your kids are fat. Right? Now they're trying to tell you to control your finances. You're in California, your state is broke. And then they have these self-help books, you know, the Dr. Phils and the Tony Robbins who are making billions, talking about Islamic principles, telling you to control your anger, manage your emotions, control your desires, etc., etc. And this is a billion-dollar business now. Because they realize that we're getting out of control here. We keep getting more and more angry, we keep getting more and more broke, we keep getting bigger and bigger as people. And there's no control. And so finally what they say is, wait a second, enough is enough. Wait a second, one second. There has to be a sense of self-control here. What happened to your freedom? No. Islam says very beautifully You have desire inside of you. It's a faculty of the soul. Al-quwwat al-shahwiya is a reality inside of every single human being. Islam is not a religion that tells you to abstain from blessing yourself from that lust and desire. We don't do that. Because the result is what happens is that you end up playing with small boys. That's what ends up happening. Because you're asked to what? To stop this blessing inside of you. Allah says no. It's a blessing from God. Lust and desire is a blessing from God. Provided it's pointing in the right direction. With what? With your aql and intellect. So Islam says you have desire? Absolutely. Go crazy. No problem. Has to be controlled by your reasoning. Because what ends up happening is what? What ends up happening is, and follow me for a second, what ends up happening is that the more you feed your desire says, I want this, you say, yes, sir, and you go get it. And your nafs is your God. Your nafs says, I want this, you go running. I want this, you go buy it. I want him, I want her, you go love him. Haram, halal, good for you, bad for you. Doesn't matter. My heart says I love him. And love is bliss. And so now this department, this faculty of desire gets bigger and bigger and stronger. Out of control. Where you say, I want this, someone says, you can't have it, you rebel against the entire system. And that's what happens to these individuals who start off being Muslims, submit to Allah, but they don't control their desires. In the name of freedom, they have made their own nafs so free that their nafs now is their God. They worship their nafs. They don't have the courage to say no to their nafs inside of them. So now this becomes this big monster now you're asked to control. Islam says control your desire. You know you can't do it. So what do? You rebel against Islam. You say, I want Islam to reform to make sure that I can live with this desire that's this big. Islam says no. Sorry. And this society now is starting to catch on. Starting to tell you to look, let's watch your food intake. They have financial analysts now on TV everywhere. You know, if you guys, there's a site called TED.com. They're called TED Talks. Great site. If you don't go on there. There's wonderful things on there. And majority of it is this idea of self-help, trying to build that humanity inside human society. And all in the name of freedom, this entire society has been completely flushed down the toilet, and now they are running to try to get somehow, somewhere, for us to elevate ourselves to a level where we're not mocked in the world, because this society now is being mocked in the world. They're simply waiting for capitalism to go down the toilet. All in the name of what? Freedom. We pride ourselves in being part of the free world. Then they go out and they export that freedom everywhere they go, and then they're shocked that the Iraqis won't accept our freedom? Really? They're fighting back? The Palestinians are fighting back against our freedom? Causes them to go back and redefine their own freedoms. And in that mix, in that pool of confusion, lies some bonehead Muslims who say, you know what, this is freedom, Islam is way off. So Islam needs to be reformed. Islam needs to change to adapt to today's time. Meanwhile, Islam continues to be the fastest growing religion in this country. Muslims are coming and they're converting tenfold, alhamdulillah, towards a religion. So we don't believe for a second that their version of freedom is free at all. We've seen the results of it in front of you. What does Islam say about freedom? Islam says that freedom does not mean that you open the bird cage, the bird goes flying wherever it wants. Freedom is enslavement, but making sure that that supreme being enslaves you. Where a person who is enslaved by that supreme being, that wajibul wujud, that necessary being that's given us existence, you're enslaved by that being, then you're free. Free from what? Ajib. Free from what? You're free from faults. You're free from vices. You're free from weaknesses. You're free from deficiencies. You're free from this faculty of desire that's become a huge monster. Why? You've enslaved yourself from a being who's created you, who simply wants you to be the best human being possible. So a person who has controlled his desire and anger with his aql is a person who's free in Islam. Because you're not run by your desires. You're not carrying that donkey up the mountain. The donkey's carrying you up the mountain like it should be. That's why when we look at the hadiths and we look at the history of someone like Hazrat Hur in Karbala, the story of Hur is a very beautiful one. Oh, mashallah, all of you have heard it. The night before Ashura, he's asking Umar ibn Sa'd, what's going to happen tomorrow? Umar ibn Sa'd, day of Ashura, what's going to happen? He says, Hur, heads will fly tomorrow. Arms will be cut off tomorrow. Blood will be shed tomorrow. Bodies will be trampled tomorrow. He looks around, he sees 72 on one side, 30,000 on another. He thinks, wait a second, something's going on here. And so his famous statement about, I was literally standing between heaven and hell. And he took his slave, he took his son, he went towards Hussein ibn Ali, he went towards heaven. He chose for that moment his akhirah as opposed to his dunya. Because desire says what? Look, be part of the winning team. You'll get your riches, you'll get your money, you'll have this supreme position in the government. He says no. He fought that desire, he went towards the akhirah. That's where my heaven is. That's why when he died, Imam Hussein looked at him and said, Hur, your mother named you correctly. You are Hur in this world. You are Hur in the hereafter as well. Hur means free in Arabic. You're free in this world. You're free in the hereafter. That's why when you come to Nahj al-Balagha, and I mentioned this before here, and Amir al-Mu'mineen describes levels of worship. The highest level of worship is what? That worship of the Ahrar, he says. The worship of the free individual. We have three types of individuals who worship Allah for three different reasons. A lot of us worship Allah out of hope for heaven. A lot of us worship Allah out of fear of hell. That highest level of worship doesn't concern itself with hope and fear, heaven or hell. It simply worships Allah because it's worthy of worship. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is layiq of worship. He's worthy of that worship. Now what you've done is you've removed the shackles of the hopes of heaven, the fear of hell. What's left is you being a free individual and worshiping Allah because he's worthy of it. And Mawla Ali labels that worship ahrar, the worship of the free. So don't get caught up in this discussion of freedom from this society. They can't even spell freedom properly. And I don't want all of you to get mixed up in this idea. So yeah, where they might ask our sisters, you know what, this hijab of yours, this modesty, this humbleness, this humility is prison for you. It's oppression for you. You're a captive in your own house. What they don't realize is a woman who is out there flaunting herself is a woman who has slaved herself. A woman who's holding on to her modesty is a woman who's very free in the eyes of Islam. Understand this for a moment. The tides are changing now, brothers and sisters. The society is getting it finally. You know, they teach you guys Abraham Maslow in school, right? Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You guys have all seen this triangle. The top one is self-actualization. You guys have all seen this, right? Examine that for a moment. Understand the entire pyramid is Islamic. Everything about it. We do what we do for physiological needs. We do what we do for shelter, for safety, for love, for self-esteem, and then for self-actualization. And it's not my topic, but very briefly, we are, as many of you should know, we are created to be perfect individuals. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I'm losing some of you. Inshallah, stay with me for a moment, please. Maslow says that the highest reason why any human being has his motivation is self-actualization. When he writes his, you know, his theory of human motivation, he presents this hierarchy of needs. If you've taken any course of psychology in college, I'm sure you've come across this pyramid. Islam says the exact same thing. The highest motivation is for us to actualize our potential to be perfect human beings. We hear about insan-e-kamil, the perfect man. We think of 14 perfect beings up here, and we're all the way down here. No, we're talking about you, your pursuit for perfection. You were created by a perfect creator. You are manifestations of a perfect creator. What he did was he created you with the potential to be perfect. It's now up to us to actualize that potential. So where Maslow says the highest point of that triangle is self-actualization, Islam has said that years ago. Where someone like Stephen Covey, who writes the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, he's made billions upon billions of dollars off of this book. All of those 7 habits are Islamic principles. He says, seek first to understand, then to be understood. He says to keep the end in mind when you start a journey. He says, sharpen the saw. All these different ones that he has, that Stephen Covey has presented, they're Islamic principles. And while the West is wowed by them, it's up to us as Muslims to present the Islamic perspective to all them. To let them know that, look, this is not news to us. We follow a religion that talks about this. So their first beef is freedom, these individuals who are reformist. You know, Islam's not free, we are free. And then society tells us how free you are. The second problem they have is with Islamic views of feminism. And when I talk about hijab and feminism, our brothers turn deaf. That's what happens usually. He's not talking about us, so you guys can go off on your thoughts. You know, I wonder if the Packers will beat the Steelers or not, that you start thinking about the Super Bowl and what's going on. And again, I told you this yesterday, that I know sometimes I'm preaching to the choir. I understand that. That all of you, mashallah, have this level of awareness. But there'll come a time, if there hasn't already, where you will be approached by individuals. You have to defend this system. And the idea of feminism in Islam, of course, requires a 10-day lecture series. Just briefly, a little bit, from Shahid Mutahari's book about women's rights, he has a very beautiful way that he describes this idea. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. You know, in the book, he discusses Surah Yasin. And Surah Yasin, ayats 38 to 40, I believe, talk about the sun and the moon in that surah. Talks about how the moon has a certain goal, the sun has a certain role to play. And then in ayat 40, it talks about the idea that the sun will never cross into the moon, the day will never become night, etc., etc. All right? He then takes that and he explains a couple of very basic concepts that I want all of you to understand. If it's a reminder for all of you, it's a reminder, inshallah. But as Shaykh Mutahri himself says, and I use this line a lot, he says, instead of reading 10 books once, sometimes it's important to read one book 10 times. Understand it completely first. He says that the same way the sun and the moon are different existences of Allah, and they tread two different paths, and provided that they don't cross the path, they will tread the path to their own perfection. The sun rises every day, it sets every day. The rising and the setting of the sun is its perfection. It's been created for that purpose. And provided it stays that way, it's perfect. If it decides to trickle into the night and says, I want to be that moonlight, chaos ensues. Now, all of a sudden, it's broken off the path of perfection. It's treading the path of chaos. It's imperfect now. The sun, the moon, the sun, day, night, night, day, what's going on? Just stay where you are, tread your path, embrace your role, Do your role, perform your duties, everything will be okay. Can I ask you guys to please shift forward a little bit and move forward? There's a little bit of traffic at the door here. My brother's here to my right. Come join me here, inshallah, please. Shant, thank you. Thank you. One more salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Right, so we're talking about this idea that the sun and the moon were created by Allah for a certain path. They tread that path, they're perfect. Apply that philosophy now to every other creation of Allah. You know, the other issue we have amongst our youth is this balance between this dunya and the akhirah, right? A lot of you don't understand how much of this dunya can I enjoy and how much of the akhirah should I be working for? Some people are so extreme, they believe that this dunya is sometimes the end all and be all. They sell out their grave for that extra house, extra car, whatever. Some are the other opposite. They completely neglect their duties in this dunya for the hopes of that castle in heaven. Two extremes exist. And so this balancing has to be understood. The same way you have the sun and the moon that have certain paths, they have certain roles. The dunya, the akhirah have a certain role, certain path. The dunya was created only to test all of us. That's it. It was created for a test. And not one test, multiple tests. And not easy tests, difficult tests. And all of you have stories, I'm sure, to tell me. The problem lies that when we start to expect from the dunya what the akhirat can give us, the hereafter is a place of itminan, inshallah, contentment, sukoon, comfort, serenity, calmness. And when you try to expect that from this dunya, it doesn't know how to give you calmness, has no idea what serenity is. That's when we have this abyss of hopelessness, depression, anxiety, suicide, where one of the biggest selling drugs in this country is Prozac. You start thinking funny, prescription is Prozac, that's your solution. The example that's often given, it's one I gave in New York, one I gave in Toronto. It's time for your exams, right? You guys all write exams, midterm finals, inshallah. You walk in, and for the exam is an hour and a half. For half an hour now, you're like, wow. What a great examination hall. You look around, you think, oh my God, it's freshly painted, Burberry carpets, French doors, crown molding. Wow, what a beautiful hall. Comfortable chairs, you're looking around, your prof then says, taps on your shoulder, says, worry about your exam. Forget about the examination room. This is not important to you. The exam is important to you. That's why sometimes when you have to make up your exams, they say, look, we don't have a room for you. We'll give you this broken down room that sometimes the janitor uses to mop. I don't care. I just want to write my exam. I don't care where it is. Just give me a room. If you say, no, I want that examination hall that seats 400 people, I want to sit in there by myself. He'll say, get out of here. But none of us will do that, right? We don't care where it is. We just want to write the examination. We do the exact same thing. We're completely wowed by this dunya. Oh my God, this dunya is gorgeous. And we don't write the exam. We're not worried about the exam in front of us. Don't expect from the dunya what it can't give you. Doesn't mean that you live a depressing, gloomy life. Of course not. I mean, it's a completely different topic altogether. But just so you understand, the importance Islam has given this world, sometimes it's not spoken to all of you. As far as you know, this dunya was divorced by Imam Ali 3 times. This dunya is a place of disgustingness. This dunya is this dunya. So you have this negative image of this dunya. So you literally strip yourself from the blessing of riding around in a nice car, having a nice home, wearing nice clothes, having a nice watch, a nice purse, etc. Islam says no. You've worked hard. You run your business. You're a professional. You've made halal money. Enjoy it. One small story to bring this point home, then I'll come to my actual point. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. It's Saturday night, inshallah. So if I go a little bit longer, it's okay. Plus tomorrow there's no lecture. So if it's okay if I take two lectures today, it's all right, inshallah. While I'm at it, there is a youth discussion tonight, inshallah, here after the program. We'll just discuss some contemporary issues, inshallah. You guys are more than welcome, brothers and sisters both. Bring your questions, inshallah. We'll discuss a few things that are relevant, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So this man approaches Mawla Ali, walks towards the first imam, wearing patches on his pants, buttons missing, ripped up shirt, laces are gone, he has his shoes tied up by rope around his feet. Mawla says, what is this? What's going on here? I'm paraphrasing, of course, I'm sure he didn't say it in that tone, but he says, what's happening here? The young man says, Imam, I just want to be one of your Shia. I want to be one of your followers. That's it. The book said that Imam Ali got upset and said that Allah has blessed you with rizq, with sustenance. Show Allah you're thankful by using that blessing. Go home and change your clothes. Wear proper clothing. Allah has blessed you. Similarly, if you have worked hard for your money, enjoy it. Now, don't make it so that, you know, you walk around saying, I'm the man, I'm rich, this and that, you know, you're lighting your cigarette by lighting up your $1 bill. No, not like that. Not like that. That's not what I'm saying to you. I'm not saying, be moderate, be humble about it. But if Allah has blessed you, alhamdulillah, then that's great. But the idea, what is it? Dunya has one path, the akhirah has one path. If you mix those two up, that's where we are bound for failure. Males and females are the exact same thing. Males have one path, females have another path in Islam. Males were created to tread one path, females were created to tread one path. Males were given the tools to tread their own path, females were given the tools to tread their own path. Where does chaos ensue? When you start to mix those two paths up. Which this society tells you. Tells our sisters, you know what? You can do what a man can do, but better. You want to be the CEO of a company? Go for it. What ends up happening is, our sister leaves that path, jumps to this path now, and chaos ensues. You don't have the tools to tread that path of a male. Similarly, we don't have the tools to tread the path of a female. And instead of fighting this idea, embrace your path. Embrace the fact that Allah has made you this way. Allah has given you things that He's not given me, Allah has given you things that that He has not given them. And so while this society will preach equality, that men and women are the exact same, Islam says no. Islam talks about justice. Islam says that we realize that women are built differently, men are built differently. So responsibilities are not based on equality, they're based on justice. That we ask women certain things because they're given those tools, we're asked men certain things because they're given those tools. Doesn't make anybody anywhere better or worse. The discussion is not about inferior, superior, it's about justice. You leave three kids home alone with their father, and I guarantee you in half an hour, he's calling the mother back. His own kids. That's why sometimes, you know, when my friends, we sit around and we discuss these things and then they say, oh, you know, tomorrow I have to babysit my kids. I go, look, you don't babysit your kids, you raise your kids. You babysit other people's kids. These are your kids. It's like, damn, that's a good point. And I was like, yeah, but that's the mentality of a man, right? I gotta babysit, I gotta watch my kids tomorrow. You're supposed to watch your kids tomorrow. This is one example. So what happens is this society now is trying to cross these paths. So we have the Mr. Moms on one side, we have the Mrs. Businesswoman on the other. And I'm not, and mind you, there will be several questions, inshallah, I know about this topic. And if I had 10 majalis, I can explore it. Right? I'm not trying to challenge anybody. I'm simply saying do not look at it through an inferior, superior window. Like this society tells you. Islam says you are worse off. You are lower than men. No, not the case. Why? So we can understand that this idea that your perfection, my sisters, is your path. Our perfection is our path. If men try to be women, women try to be men, no one's going to be perfect. And thus we have this situation right now. Why do we have broken homes? Why do we have domestic issues? Why are homes on fire? Why are there high divorce rates? Why are kids off the path? Why is there so much silent suffering happening in the homes? Because nobody asks us ever, is this wajib, is that haram? It's all about counseling. I can't raise my kid properly. My wife doesn't do this for me. My husband doesn't do this for me. Men have become individuals who simply don't care. They sit at home, they do nothing. Meanwhile, their women and their kids are hungry. The complaint that I get from this side is men aren't men anymore nowadays. Because the reality is that Allah has given us the tools to support and defend our home. Way back in the caveman eras, you know, they would leave their homes and defend their homes and go out and get food for their woman. But today we don't see that, unfortunately. At the same idea, the woman has this emotional support inside of her to create heaven for her family inside the home that a man can't do. Small examples. So the same way we don't expect our women to defend and support us as men is the same way that we don't have the tools to make this community, these homes, heaven for us. That blessing has been given to our sisters. It's not about inferior, superior. It's not about equality. It never was about equality. It's all about justice. Allah gave you some tools. Allah expects you to use those tools towards your perfection. Why can't I work? Wait. You can work if you want to. But the idea is to embrace what Allah has given you. Don't fight it. The society and the reformers will tell our sisters that you have been lowered in the eyes of Allah. That Bibi Hawa, Eve, was made from a rib of Adam. Not true. It starts off from that first creation. So all these things need to be battled and understood. The mindset has to change. This society will tell you everybody's on the same page. The example that often my teachers give us is, look, you're sitting there for dinner and so is your six-month-old child. Okay? You order pizza, you have your slice, you give him his slice. He's 6 months old, doesn't have one tooth. And you're saying, look, why aren't you eating your pizza? I don't understand. Equality, right? I have pizza, you have pizza. I have the same lunch you have. No, equality says that this is wrong. Justice says you have your pizza, he has his baby food. That's justice. Let's not get those two mixed up, inshallah. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Yes, where there is equality is at the submission level. We're talking about taqwa. If you have a woman who is muttaqi, you have a brother who is muttaqi, yes, Allah looks at him at the exact same level. We talk about these worldly dimensions, there has to be a difference, and there is a difference. Embrace that difference. So two issues here tonight, and we move towards Masaib now. Where does this modernist viewpoint come about? Whatever article you read, you research up and down the internet, they always talk about freedom. Islam strips you of your freedom. Islam strips our females of equality. And so I felt the need tonight to discuss these two issues. Now, if there are questions, I ask you, don't leave here confused. Don't make up your own mind. Don't bash me behind my back. You want to come talk to me? Approach me. You have questions? Come approach me. I'm here all night tonight. If you need clarification, come to me to clarify. Don't go to somebody else to clarify. We always have that in our communities. You know, I had one individual come to me and say, oh, this brother needs clarification about what you said. He didn't agree with what you said. I go, fine, tell him to come to me. A day, 2 day passes, nothing happens. I'm coming out, I'm putting my shoes on. The brother is there and the brother who needs clarification is there. The brother turns to the brother and says, look, he's sitting right here, ask him your question. He goes, no, I'm okay, and he walks away. We don't like that. I don't like it. Discuss it with me. I'm not going to bite your head off. Right? We'll sit down, we'll discuss, challenge it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I can learn from you. But this is a reality of the situation. This society has taught our sisters especially that you should feel like you are exactly the same as males. Why do you want to be exactly the same as males? Our responsibility is tenfold compared to you. We feed our kids, we pay their rent, we're the ones that are responsible for that. On the day of judgment, we're going to be asked about our families. Not all of you. So anyways, these issues have to be, first of all, accepted by us. A lot of our sisters, our brothers don't accept these things in the hearts of their heart. And they're too scared to bring it up. So maybe these discussions are beneficial. One salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Because the reality is, and again, I don't want to go into this topic, but the reality is that if you look at Karbala, you see that the sister of Imam Hussein, Bibi Zainab Sallallahu Alaiha, played two roles in this tragedy. You know, and I know that today, mashallah, you guys had Zainab there, inshallah, this message was brought about. You know, the slogan on that poster was freedom in captivity, right? That was your slogan? It's a beautiful slogan. I hope that was pursued in the keynote speech. Because that's exactly what it is. We have so many individuals who are imprisoned, but they're free. Oh, people who are free, but they're imprisoned. Understand that for a moment. Bibi Zainab was never imprisoned. She was free. And yes, on the outside, the zahir, on the apparent, maybe she was a captive. But the reality is that as long as Imam Hussein was there pre-Ashura, she played the role of making sure the women, the children, and the tents were all looking after. But the moment Imam Hussein was shaheed, she took on the role of her father. And she took the imamat of Imam Sajjad on her back, literally, from Karbala to Kufa, Kufa to Damascus. And today, if we had this commemoration, it's because of a woman, the sister of Imam Hussein, who stood there in the courtyard of Yazid and delivered a historical khutbah that made grown men cry and hide their faces. That's the reality of a woman in Islam. That's the power that she has. Her mother did it against Fadak, and she did it again in the courtyard of Yazid. And time again, she was so patient and so submissive. She persevered time and time again. We sit up here on these chairs and we mention the events of Karbala, and all of you listen and your hearts break and you cry. Can you imagine those eyes that saw these events happen? Can you imagine the heart that witnessed these events that we are reporting every single year? But we see that night on Shami Ghariba, when she saw everybody one by one give their life, when she stood there on Tila Zainabiyah and she saw Shimon on the chest of her brother, that night she performed Salatul Layl. This is the same Bibi Zainab. 1,000 salams to you. 1,000 salams to you. The same Bibi Zainab who stood there and watch this conversation between Ali and Akbar and Imam Hussein. You know that if there was one shahada that almost killed Imam Hussein, it was a shahada of his 18, 21-year-old son. Where Ayatollah Naini narrates that one night after reciting the musibat of Karbala, that night in my dream Imam Hussein was standing in front of me, and from head to toe, he had arrows all over his body. The next night when I recited the musibat again, that night when he came in my dream, all the arrows were gone, but two arrows were left. And when Naini asked Imam Hussein that, "Mawla, last night your body was covered in arrows, tonight there's only two arrows." He says, "Naini, every single time that one of my Shias cry for my musibah, one arrow is pulled out of my body." He says, "What about these two arrows that are remaining in your body?" Abu Abdullah, he says, Na'ini, there are two arrows and two sources of pain that no matter how much anyone cries, they'll never leave my body. One is the arrow of Abbas, and one is the arrow of Ali Akbar. But the reality is that when this beautiful son of Imam Hussein went to him on the day of Ashura asking for permission to give his life, Imam Hussein instantly gave permission to Ali Akbar, but he said that there are conditions. He said that as you ride into the Maidan of Karbala, every so often, if you can, just turn back and look at me. This was the face that reminded Imam Hussein of his grandfather. This was the man that every single time Imam Hussein wanted to remember his grandfather, the way he walked, the way he talked, the way he looked, he would look at Ali Akbar's face. Every so often, he said, just look back and just let me know that I can see your face. When Ali Akbar was given permission and he rode towards the Maidan of Karbala, my parents in the audience who have teenage children, Imam Hussein, the books say, ran after the horse of Ali Akbar. And Sheikh Abbas Qumin Nafasul Mahmoud narrates that the way that Imam Hussein was running after Ali Akbar, you only saw that one other time in history. When Imam Hussein left Medina to go towards Karbala, and he went to go say his alwida and goodbyes to Rasulullah, he walked towards the grave of his grandfather like a man on a mission. Focused, completely determined. But when he went to go say his goodbyes to his mother, he walked towards the grave like a child walks towards his mother he hasn't seen in several months, stumbling and running as if his mother is going to go away again, collapses on the grave of his mother and says, Amma, I'm leaving Medina now. I'm completely alone now. No one's with me. Not Hassan is with me. You're not with me. Not my Baba is with me. They say the only other time that they saw Imam Hussein run that way was when he was following Ali Akbar towards the battlefield of Karbala. Ali Akbar says, Baba, you gave me permission. Why are you following me? He says, if only you had Olad like I have in you. If only you had a son like I had in you. Ali Akbar is hit with the spear. I don't have the himmat to read the whole shahadat. He runs and he completely falls off of the horse. He says, Alayka minni salam, Ya Aba Abdullah. He comes running towards Ali Akbar. Ali Akbar has one hand on his chest and one hand on the shoulder of his father. Imam Hussein is asking Ali Akbar, where is your other hand? Why can't you show me your other hand? Ali Akbar is silent, doesn't say a word. At that moment, Imam Hussein moves back. He sees that Ali Akbar is clutching his chest. He removes his son's hand. He sees there's a spear that completely lies in the chest of his own son. He lays down Ali Akbar on the plains of Karbala. He holds this spear with his hand, he turns towards Najaf, begins talking to his father. He says, Baba, there's no doubt that you ripped the door of Khaybar that took 40 men to open and close, but have you ever ripped a spear out of the chest of your young son's chest? He says, no. At that moment, he grabs the spear. Every single time, my brothers and my sisters, he would try to dislodge the spear out of the chest of Ali Akbar. Ali Akbar's body would go up and down off the plains of Karbala. At that moment, they say that Imam Hussein put one knee on the chest of Ali Akbar, put one foot on the plains of Karbala, grabbed the spear of Ali Akbar, turned towards Najaf again, said, Ya Ali, and pulled the spear out of it. بعد تو نمونم بز خدا حافظ بذار تا چشاتو ببینم اون صورت ما تو ببینم کمی جلو بابا را برو من قد و بالا تو ببینم